From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of how FBI double agent Robert Philip Hansen betrayed his country and his family. He sold secrets to the Soviets while using surveillance technology in his bedroom to allow a friend to spy on him and his wife. We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Weiss, author of The Bureau and the Mole. Also, Milo Miles reviews a 3-CD set of Velvet Underground concert recordings from 1969. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Dozens of fighters from Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network, who had been captured in Pakistan, rose up against their Pakistani guards today. Officials say 7 al-Qaeda fighters and 6 police were killed in the ensuing gun battle. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Islamabad.
More than 150 al-Qaeda fighters were being transported from the border town of Parachinar to the city of Peshawar when some of the fighters attacked their Pakistani guards. They commandeered the prison bus they were riding in and, in trying to drive to freedom, crashed the vehicle. In the brief but bloody gun battle that followed, al-Qaeda militants and Pakistani police were killed, and dozens of captives managed to escape. 21 were recaptured immediately, but at least 20 were still on the run. Pakistan has been pouring helicopters and soldiers into its border region since al-Qaeda fighters began to cross the border from the Tora Bora region of Afghanistan. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Islamabad.
The U.S. and European Union say they're in agreement on the broad outlines of a Middle East policy. They're urging Palestinian President Yasser Arafat to ensure that his demand for an end to terrorism against Israel is carried out. Secretary of State Colin Powell and the EU president announced a united front on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict after a meeting at the State Department. The White House and Democratic-controlled Senate remain at odds over the shape of a federal spending package. That's despite a trip to Capitol Hill this morning by President Bush. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
President Bush traveled to Capitol Hill today and announced that a compromise on an economic stimulus package had been reached between House Republicans and a small number of moderate Democrats in the Senate. But shortly afterwards, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle said that word of a deal was news to him. The move by the White House seemed designed to put pressure on Democrats to accept the White House version of an economic stimulus, or risk being blamed by the public if a package isn't passed by the time Congress takes its month-long holiday break starting this Friday. The economic stimulus has stalled in the Democratic-controlled Senate, with the final difficult sticking point being how to provide help to laid-off workers who need to buy health care insurance. Democrats in the Senate are invoking a procedural rule requiring that the legislation have 60 votes to pass. It's a strategy that's frequently employed by both parties. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
About 40 laid-off Enron workers today gathered at a park near their former Houston offices to talk about what they're not getting from the company. They claim Enron has not been clear on severance benefits. The energy trading company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection last week. The former Enron workers say they're having a hard time getting answers to questions, such as when and if the embattled company will ask a bankruptcy judge to approve severance payments. Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 72 points. The Nasdaq was down 22. This is NPR News. The Argentine government has declared a state of siege today. Police fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse looters. The rioting is the result of economic chaos in Argentina, triggered by government austerity measures. A federal grand jury has indicted Tyson Foods with 36 counts of conspiracy to smuggle illegal immigrants. That after a 2.5-year undercover operation run by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Tyson Foods denies the charges against the company, saying any criminal acts were committed by a few managers acting outside of corporate knowledge. But Justice Department Assistant Attorney General Michael Chertoff claims otherwise.
This was not an isolated episode or series of episodes, but really a wide-ranging systemic conspiracy that lasted over a period of 6 years.
The government says Tyson told INS agents posing as job recruiters to pick up illegal immigrants at the U.S.-Mexico border and take them to processing plants throughout the U.S. Federal prosecutors say Tyson executives condoned the criminal activity in order to have enough workers to meet tight production deadlines. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
New York's governor says the fires have finally gone out at the World Trade Center. Governor George Pataki says just in the last week the fires have been put out. Pataki made the announcement to a group of about 50 upstate elected officials during a tour of the disaster site today. Fire damage may move Christmas services from New York's landmark Cathedral Church of St. John the Divine. Officials had been hoping to offer a holiday service at the century-old church, but the fire yesterday prompted some environmental concerns, and now plans may have to change. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to hear the story of how FBI agent Robert Philip Hansen betrayed his country and his family. Last July, Hansen pleaded guilty to 13 counts of espionage. Over the course of his 25 years with the FBI, he sold secrets to the Soviets, drawing on his access to classified documents from the FBI, CIA, National Security Agency, National Security Council, and the Pentagon. While he spied on his own country, he set up surveillance technology in his bedroom, allowing a friend to spy on Hansen's intimate relations with his wife. My guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Weiss, is the author of a new book about Hansen called The Bureau and the Mole. Weiss is a national staff writer for The Washington Post. He interviewed more than 100 people, including current and retired FBI agents and members of the Hansen family, but he can't reveal many of his sources because they wanted to remain anonymous. I asked him to describe the most important secrets Hansen sold to the Soviets.
The most important secrets that Hansen sold to the Soviets are, first of all, the continuity of government plan. That was the super-secret program to ensure the survival of the president, the Congress, and government operations in the event of a nuclear first strike against the United States. That actually, at least in theory, increased the risk of nuclear war because the Russians, with that information, believed that they could win such a war. He also sold to the Russians information about the existence of a secret spy tunnel that had been built by the National Security Agency and operated by the FBI underneath the Russian embassy in Washington. Cost several hundred million dollars of taxpayers' money to build, and it was compromised completely and totally by Hansen, and rather than gaining information and insight into what the Russians were doing, they fed misinformation into it. The other thing that Hansen did was give up the identities of at least 9 Soviet officials who had been recruited to spy for the United States. 3 of these men were brought back to Moscow and executed after being exposed by Hansen.
Did he actually sell any nuclear secrets to the Soviets?
He sold more information than any spy in American history. He had a computer expertise that enabled him to sell not only information from the FBI, but also information from the CIA, the National Security Agency, the White House's National Security Agency, the White House National Security Council, and the Pentagon. And in that mix of things was the holy of holies. All the confidential information about the budget and plans for the intelligence community. And he even sold something, Terry, that ended up in the hands, U.S. intelligence believes, of Osama bin Laden.
What?
He sold something called the Community Online Intelligence System to the Russian government. And the Russian, not the Russian government, but probably some individual in Russia, sold that to bin Laden, who, according to U.S. intelligence, was able to use the information to evade U.S. efforts to track and monitor the fugitive terrorist.
Is there any way of knowing what other impact the secrets that he sold to the Soviets had on the relationship between America and the Soviets?
Well, I think there is, because there are people now working throughout government who feel as much as 20 years of their work is out the window, out the door. The Russians learned about how the U.S. listened in on their conversations around the world. All of that was shot. The Russians learned about the sources and methods employed by the United States to recruit Russians to spy for the United States. And they also learned remarkably about a tremendous amount of what I would call super secret information that was classified at the very highest level.
David Vise is my guest. He's a reporter for The Washington Post and author of a new book about Robert Philip Hansen, the FBI double agent who sold secrets to the Soviets. His new book is called The Bureau and the Mole. To understand why Hansen became a double agent and sold secrets to the Soviets, it's useful to go back to the very beginning of the story, back to his childhood. Hansen's father was a cop. His father abused him. What did Hansen's father do that qualified as abuse?
Well, Terry, there was both physical abuse and emotional abuse. When Robert Hansen was a young boy, his father physically abused him. He wrapped him in towels and twirled him round and round and round until he became ill and literally threw up, and physically abused him as well by grabbing his legs and stretching them apart and giving him tremendous pain in the groin area. All of that had a tremendous influence on Hansen's mind and its development in terms of his ability to trust and his ability to feel a loss of a sense of control. And there are examples over and over again of his father berating his son publicly and doing things privately that undermined his confidence and made Robert Hansen feel that his father, a Chicago policeman, was really a corrupt cop.
Hansen wanted to join the FBI. He became a cop first. Now, his father didn't want him to be a cop. His father wanted him to be a doctor, you report. But he became a cop anyways. And then he joined the FBI. So I guess his father wouldn't have wanted him to join the FBI either. Do you think that was part of the whole thing, like intentionally defying his father?
I think after the abuse he had received, much of Robert Hansen's life was about getting back at his dad. He wanted to go into law enforcement, even though his dad had abused him. He respected the work his father did as a Chicago cop. But Terry, when he went into the Chicago Police Department, he joined a special unit called C5, which investigated corrupt cops. He then had the opportunity to join the FBI. And I think his dad actually felt better about that than he did about him serving on the Chicago Police Force, because the FBI is recognized as the elite law enforcement organization in the United States. But once he was in the FBI and he didn't feel he was promoted properly, he began to view the FBI just like his dad and began to do a number of things that completely and totally betrayed the trust that had been placed in him at the highest levels of the FBI and turned to spying.
Yeah, you report that he felt underappreciated at the FBI. He resented the Bureau. He didn't like the way the bureaucracy was handled. What were his criticisms besides the ego ones, besides the ones like, you don't appreciate me enough?
He worshipped the ground that J. Edgar Hoover had walked on. He wished that the FBI still was in the autocratic Hoover era, where the FBI men wore dark suits and white shirts. Hansen developed the nickname the Mortician, and the Dr. Death, because he dressed like the FBI agents did many years ago. And he felt really that it had been all downhill since Hoover left. And he didn't feel the other agents shared his passion and shared his commitment. He planned a whole secret raid on the Russians when he was working in New York. And most of the other guys at the Bureau didn't show up because they didn't want to work on Sunday. So, you know, he didn't really have the interpersonal skills to be promoted effectively in management. That was one problem. But he didn't develop the friendships either. So when the boys would go out drinking after work, they wouldn't ask Bob Hansen to join them. And increasingly, within the fraternity built on fidelity, bravery, and integrity, Hansen felt like an outsider.
Yeah, you quote one agent as saying about Hansen, he was creepy and no one wanted to talk in front of him.
He had the ability to hide in plain sight. And some people became reluctant to talk about him, but he made it his business to be inside any number of meetings and had the kind of personality and demeanor that enabled him to sit in a room quietly, silently, and go unnoticed. And people had absolutely no idea that this man, who was the top Soviet analyst for the FBI and who was home for dinner at 5:30 every night with his wife and children, had this other life where he was selling information to the Russians, where he was posting information and stories that he wrote about his wife, sexual fantasies, really, on the internet, and where he had a kind of James Bond lifestyle that provided him with an escape from the pain that he felt at the Bureau and the pain that he had felt since he was a child.
My guest is Washington Post reporter David Weiss. He's the author of the book The Bureau and the Mole about FBI double agent Robert Philip Hansen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest David Weiss is the author of The Bureau and the Mole, a new book about Robert Philip Hansen, a double agent in the FBI who sold many secrets to the Soviets. So Hansen was the top Soviet analyst at the FBI when he started selling secrets to the Soviets. How did he make his first contact with the Soviets offering to sell secrets?
He made his first contact all the way back in 1979, not to the KGB, but to the Soviet military intelligence in New York. And he gave up information at that time revealing the identity of a Soviet in the United Nations mission who went by the codename Top Hat and who was a very, very valuable source for the United States of information. And he later was called back to Russia and executed. Not long after he began spying in New York, he was sitting downstairs in the basement of his home, and his wife Bonnie walked in on him. And he became very flustered and upset, covered up the papers in front of him, and Bonnie thought that he was writing a love letter to another woman, because in the very first week of his marriage, she had gotten a phone call from a woman who said, "Your husband and I have just made love. He really wants me, not you. So butt out." And she was afraid that once again it was marital infidelity, but instead he said no. He was writing a letter to the Russians, and he told his wife Bonnie that he was selling them worthless information and tricking them.
And she bought that.
Well, she didn't know what to think, and so she said, "What we need to do is to go see a priest." And Bonnie was a member of, and is a member of, Opus Dei, a very strict movement within Catholicism. She is a woman of tremendous spirituality and a woman of tremendous devotion. So the two of them went to see a priest in New York, and they asked him what to do after explaining the story. And ultimately, the priest advised Hansen to give the money away that the Russians had paid him to the charities of Mother Teresa and to promise not to do it again and to repent for what he had done. And so Bob Hansen said he did those things, promised his wife he would never spy again, and 5 years later, he couldn't resist the temptation.
Well, I want to get back to Opus Dei a little bit later, but let's keep on with this early contact that he had with the Soviets. You reprint a letter that he sent to Viktor Cherkasin, who was his contact when he started spying for the Soviets. He was a KGB officer in Washington who, you say, also handled spy Aldrich Ames. Would you like to read an excerpt of that letter?
"Dear Mr. Cherkasin, soon I will send a box of documents to Mr. Degtyar. They are from certain of the most sensitive and highly compartmented projects of the U.S. intelligence community. All are originals to aid in verifying their authenticity. Please recognize for our long-term interest that there are a limited number of persons with this array of clearances. As a collection, they point to me. I trust that an officer of your experience will handle them appropriately. I believe they are sufficient to justify a $100,000 payment to me. I must warn of certain risks to my security of which you may not be aware. Details regarding payment and future contact will be sent to you personally. My identity and actual position in the community must be left unstated to ensure my security." And then Hansen went on to develop a secret code system so that if any of their communications were intercepted in the future, people would not know exactly when and where they planned to do dead drops, where Hansen would leave documents at one place, the Russians would pick them up, they'd leave him cash at another place or the same spot, and he would pick it up later. And he said, "I want no specialized tradecraft." I mean, this, Terry, is really what I would call high concept, low tech. "I will add 6 and you subtract 6 from stated months, days, and times in both directions of our future communications." Hansen did something remarkable, never done before in the history of espionage in the United States. He spied for the Russians for more than 20 years, and during that entire period, they never learned his identity.
How was that possible? How was he able to keep his identity secret from them?
He kept his identity secret from them by giving up extremely valuable information up front, which proved that he was a bona fide agent who knew what he was doing, by going to the right man, Viktor Cherkashin, in the Russian embassy, and by employing brilliant tradecraft. The Russians cared most about gaining valuable information, and they were willing to play by his rules. And so he set up a system of dead drops where the two would never meet face to face, and where the letters and other communications he sent to them were sent under aliases. Particularly, he used Ramon Garcia, or B. His KGB case file was known as B. And so the Russians never knew if he was with the FBI, with the CIA, where he was. And in fact, his tradecraft was so good, Terry, that even after the FBI, with the help of the CIA, got the original documents back from the KGB, even they couldn't figure out who it was when they looked at it. He was an absolutely first-rate spy in terms of his tradecraft. And he turned down all opportunities presented by the Russians to travel abroad, to meet with them face-to-face. He knew that the biggest mistake most spies had made was to let the people they were spying for know their identity, and then one day they would be given up. Not this guy.
So how did Hansen organize his drop-offs, his method of leaving the information for the Soviets and letting them know where to find it?
He used a system of signal sites and communication sites with the Russians so they would know when he had dropped something off. He used masking tape, scotch tape, high grade, of course. And in return, the Russians or he would use thumbtacks placed in telephone poles, and the different signal sites would be marked indicating that a dead drop was coming, that Hansen would be going to a park or a place near his home, take the information that he was going to sell to the Russians, place it inside a black garbage bag, and leave it under a footbridge where they could come and claim it. Later, he would then return after seeing that the Russians had cleared the site, and he would then pick up wads of cash that they left for him in return.
It's so low-tech.
It is so low-tech, and I think the reason he was able to avoid even detection from his own family, for the most part, is that most of the dead drop sites were within 10 minutes of his home. So you say to the family, "Hey, I'm going to go pick up a quart of milk at the grocery store," and on his way there, he might drop off the documents, and on his way back, he might pick up the cash.
Did he always name his fee like he did in that first letter where he said, "I think this is worth $100,000?
Not always. In fact, at one point he said to them, "I don't know what to do with all of this cash. It's too much money." And so the Russians established a bank account for him, probably one of the greatest deals the Soviet Union ever made economically. They placed about $800,000 in a Russian bank account, so they told him in his name. And of course, he never saw a penny of that.
Because he was busted too soon?
When he was arrested, that money was still in Russia in the bank, if it was ever there. And he had asked them about an escape plan and would the money be waiting for me there in Russia, and they assured him that it will or that it would. But over the years, the Russians got all that information, deposited $800,000, they told him, in a secret bank account there, and the money went right back to the Russian government.
Let's talk about Hansen's religion. He belonged to Opus Dei. How would you describe that group spiritually and politically?
Opus Dei is a very powerful movement within the Catholic Church, not large in numbers, about 80,000 adherents worldwide, but very conservative movement. And Opus Dei is very rigorous. When you are a member of Opus Dei, as Hansen was, his wife had gotten this from her mom, and she encouraged him to join. When you're a member of Opus Dei, you pray a certain number of times a day. You go to meetings. The men meet one night a week. The women meet another night. When you devote your life to spirituality, Opus Dei also has another side to it, Terry. Many people within the church and others feel that it's sort of cult-like, and that a lot of people who are taken into the movement are brainwashed. They give up their material possessions. They give up their independence and decision-making. They adopt a monastic lifestyle. One of Hansen's children is devoting her entire life to Opus Dei, and she'll never marry. She's always willing to go anywhere and do anything to help spread the Opus Dei in Latin means work of God, to spread the work of God and the word of God. And it also requires her to do a number of things that seem out of touch with, to most people, I would think, with the way modern American life is anyway, sleeping on a wooden board at night, not seen in public alone with any individual. And so we're talking about a very, very strict, conservative movement within the Catholic Church and a truly unique operation. Louis Free's brother is a member or was a member of Opus Dei as well. And so it is one of the least known, most powerful movements around. People in high-ranking positions in the Vatican are members of Opus Dei. And one of our Supreme Court justices, Scalia, is a member of Opus Dei. And it becomes your social life and social fabric, as it did for Hansen and for his wife, Bonnie.
David Weiss is the author of The Bureau and the Mole. We'll talk more about Robert Philip Hansen in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. And sponsored in part by Nonsuch Records, featuring composer John Adams' El Nino, an oratorio on the Nativity story featuring Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, Dawn Upshaw, and Willard White, conducted by Kent Nagano. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Because Andy said, why don't you write a song about Edie? So we did. It's called Femme Fatale.
Coming up, Myla Miles reviews a 3-CD set of 1969 Velvet Underground concerts, and we continue our discussion about FBI double agent Robert Philip Hansen.
Here she comes. You better watch your step. She's going to break your heart in two. Oh, it's true. It's not hard to realize. Just look into
the things she does to me.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Washington Post reporter David Weiss, author of The Bureau and the Mole, the story of FBI double agent Robert Philip Hansen. In July, the 25-year veteran of the Bureau pleaded guilty to 13 charges of espionage. He sold national security and intelligence secrets to the Russians. When we left off, we were talking about his membership in the Catholic movement Opus Dei. How would you explain Hansen belonging to a very conservative form of Catholicism and at the same time violating every moral code, both in terms of the secrets he sold, sexual codes, family codes, you name it, he violated it?
That's a great question, because Opus Dei, among other things, is extremely anti-communist. Robert Hansen had an incredible ability to compartmentalize in his mind. At some level, all of us compartmentalize a little bit. We go to work, we have jobs, we have relationships outside work with family, with friends, and other things. He developed the ability to compartmentalize at the extreme. He wasn't merely living a facade, putting up a facade to conceal his spying. And so, Terry, he could totally embrace Opus Dei and Catholicism. And when he was in church, when he was at Opus Dei meetings, he was sincere and totally committed to that movement and to the church. When he was at home and flying the flag on the 4th of July, he was as proud to be an American as anyone at that moment. At the same time, the spying gave him a sense of power. The spying made him a player. He went from being an overlooked analyst, he felt, at the FBI to someone who was communicating directly with the head of the KGB in Moscow. And so I think he could do these things, Terry, because he could compartmentalize, and he could do them because he had a fractured ego seeking recognition, and he got it. The Russians validated his importance and played on the lack of friends that he had in his life by coming across in their communications with him as a true friend.
Is this what psychiatrists told you about him?
Yes. What I did, Terry, to try to really understand him was try to talk to his family members and friends and classmates over the years and fellow FBI agents, gather as much information as I possibly could about every aspect of his life, and then go to psychologists and psychiatrists and experts in forensics and human behavior to explain how this could take place. I wanted to have expert input to help me understand the motivation and personality of the most complex man I've ever encountered.
You write about Robert Philip Hansen's private life as well as his spying life, and his private life was pretty crazy. In fact, he set up a system so that a friend of his could basically spy on him and his wife, could watch Hansen and his wife having sexual relations. Why don't you describe the system that Hansen set up in his house so his friend could watch him having sex?
Hansen had a buddy from childhood named Jack Hoshower. And he looked up to Jack a great deal. Jack went to Vietnam and fought in the war. Jack really became, I think, a substitute father figure in Bob Hansen's mind. And so this all began before the video system. When Jack was in Vietnam, he began sending him naked photographs of Bonnie Hansen. And Jack said, wait a minute, you must be doing something wrong or have made a mistake. I didn't want you to send these here. And Bob said, no, I want you to see how beautiful Bonnie is, how ravishing she is. And Jack was there in Vietnam and I suppose got to the point of saying he was a man in Vietnam on his own, happy to look at pictures of a beautiful woman. One thing led to another, and this was always at the invitation of Robert Hansen, to validate his manhood, I believe. He did something without his wife's knowledge. He put a closed-circuit video camera in the bedroom of their Vienna, Virginia home. And when his friend Jack Hoshower came to visit, Jack watched in the other room via closed-circuit television as Bob Hansen and his wife had sex. And Bob set this camera up in a way that would enable Jack to watch it without anyone else in the house knowing. And he even did it as recently as just a few years ago. And so this was not something that happened in the early years of marriage or in adolescence. It was something that went on and on. Bonnie Hansen always had a sixth sense that she felt uncomfortable around Jack. She didn't like it when Jack, who lives in Germany, would come to visit and stay at their home. But she didn't know why. She didn't know what. And she certainly didn't know, as Robert Hansen wrote in one of his internet postings, that she was an unwitting porn star.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, it wasn't enough for him to be watched having sex, watched by his friend while he had sex. He had to write about it on the internet in a chat room. It's like a double layer of voyeurism that he needed to know was going on. In fact, would you like to read an excerpt of that posting just to give us a sense of how his mind worked?
At a security show, we bought sub-miniature video cameras designed for surveillance purposes. We bought two, which could relay the signals from the cameras in place in our bedroom down to our den. After some experimentation, while Bonnie was out of town for a few days, we set up a great system. Jack could sit in our den when he visited and see everything up in the bedroom. This proved no end of fun during his visits. Often now, he'll stay 5 or 6 days doing things like research on his PhD thesis at the various libraries here. On recent trips in the mornings, he sits and watches Bonnie on the large screen TV in our den as she gets showered and dressed. Bonnie still fixes her hair while nude each morning. At night, he watches the nightly sex scene, or once, Bonnie modeling her Victoria's Secret white nylons, sheer bra and heels, for me, before we expletive deleted. That really got us all going.
Do you know how his wife Bonnie reacted when she found out that she'd been videotaped, that he'd written about her naked on the internet?
I do. That information was actually transmitted to her after Bob Hansen's arrest by a psychiatrist who visited Bob in prison. Bob told him what he had done, and the psychiatrist persuaded Bob to allow him to let Bonnie know. And Bonnie was really upset. As any woman would be, as any person would be. But Terry, you have to understand, Bonnie Hansen is a believer in Catholicism who also is a forgiving soul. Some people would say she's naive. Other people would say she is completely and totally devout. She reacted at first by becoming extremely upset, by trembling, by crying, by doing all of the normal things that you and I would do. But then she comes back on the rebound as a loyal spouse, not only standing by her man, but telling her children that she doesn't want to hear about all this sexual stuff and all the marital infidelities, that her husband, Robert Hansen, is a good man, that he was a good husband, that he's been a good father to their 6 children. And he, I believe, manipulated her over the years into believing that she was truly in control of the house and truly in control of their lives while he was really doing all this stuff. And there are some who say that even from his prison cell, he's continued to manipulate her. In one of his letters to the Russians, he wrote about wanting an escape plan, a way to get to Moscow. And when Bonnie and others asked him about this recently in prison, he said, "Oh, I never considered leaving you, Bonnie. I love you. You are everything to me. You are what makes life worth living." And she prays for his soul each and every day, visits him in prison regularly, and still feels as though they are husband and wife.
My guest is Washington Post reporter David Weiss, author of The Bureau and The Mole. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Weiss, author of The Bureau and the Mole, about FBI double agent Robert Philip Hansen, who sold secrets to the Russians. He pleaded guilty to 13 charges of espionage in July. What was the collapse of the Soviet Union like for Robert Philip Hansen? Here he was spying for the Soviets, and then the whole Soviet system falls apart.
When the Soviet system fell apart about a decade ago, Robert Hansen became very concerned that he might somehow become detected. And so after spying from 1985 until 1991, he cut off his spying activities. He was extremely disciplined, Terry. This was a mole who knew how to avoid detection. He saw that a KGB delegation on a friendly basis came to the FBI, and he feared that he'd know one of them or that somehow someone would figure out who he was. And so he had the self-discipline after spying for 6 years and giving away hundreds of thousands of pages of sensitive classified intelligence to stop spying in 1991. And he did not resume his spying activities until 1999, when a new regime came to power and there was a move back in the direction of the old guard in Russia.
In March of 2000, he sends a letter to his Soviet contact that you describe as revealing his fragile emotional state. I'd like you to read an excerpt of that letter.
"I have come about as close as I ever want to come to sacrificing myself to help you, and I get silence. I hate silence. Conclusion. One might propose that I am either insanely brave or quite insane. I'd answer neither. I'd say insanely loyal. Take your pick. There is insanity in all the answers. I have, however, come as close to the edge as I can without being truly insane. My security concerns have proven reality-based. I'd say pin your hopes on insanely loyal and go for it. Only I can lose. I decided on this course when I was 14 years old. I'd read Philby's book. Now that is insane, eh? My only hesitations were my security concerns under uncertainty. I hate uncertainty. So far, I have judged the edge correctly. Give me credit for that. Set the signal at my site any Tuesday evening. I will read your answer. Please, at least say goodbye. It's been a long time, my dear friends. A long and lonely time. Signed, Ramon Garcia."
What inspired this letter? Why was he complaining that his only response had been silence from the Soviets, from the Russians?
He was complaining because he had resumed contact with them in 1999, and rather than being nurtured along as a friend in the way that they did in his earlier contacts, they were not responding to him in the same ways. The communications were cold. They were almost lists of information that the Russians wanted, and he had indicated in three letters he wrote to the Russians that he had a desire to begin spying anew. And in some instances, he was not receiving responses to his communications. And after leaving signal sites, I mean, a vertical mark of white adhesive tape, 8 centimeters in length, left on a signpost in Foxstone Park, and after leaving other communications for them, you know, a white thumbtack he bought at CVS drugstore, on an electric utility pole, the Russians didn't respond. And so he felt that they had left him. I mean, they had written him a letter that said, "Dear friend, welcome," when he came back to spying in 1999. "Dear friend, welcome. We express our sincere joy on the occasion of resumption of contact with you." So here's this man carrying around this tremendous secret of being a spy. He resumes contact after 8 years. He gets a letter that says, "Dear friend," and he's ready to resume a friendship. Only the other party isn't willing to be the same kind of friend it was before.
Let's talk a little bit about how the FBI discovered that Hansen was a double agent and that he was giving secrets to the Russians. First of all, his brother-in-law, who was also an FBI agent, an agent based in Chicago, sensed that something suspicious was happening, and he talked to the FBI in 1990 and said, "Look, my brother-in-law might be a spy." And what did the FBI do?
The FBI blew it. FBI agent Mark Walk, Hansen's brother-in-law, went to the Bureau, said, "You ought to investigate my brother-in-law for spying on behalf of Russia. He's got too much cash around the house. He's spending money too freely. Something is wrong," and the FBI didn't follow up, and it was a colossal failure. Reminiscent of the information that came in from Minneapolis recently, where the Minneapolis field office reported to headquarters that there were people there who wanted to learn how to fly planes but not how to land them.
So how did the FBI finally pick up on the fact that Hansen was spying?
In the fall of 2000, someone with the KGB actually turned the Hansen file over in Moscow to a CIA agent. And it was the original case file. That file made its way to the FBI
They got the original documents back, and they still didn't know who he was based on that. And in fact, they misidentified and went after someone who works for the CIA initially, earlier, who was wrong. But at any event, they had that file. They went back to the Russians, and they said, is there anything more you can give us? And they sent a black garbage bag that Hansen had used to store documents that he had given to the Russians. The FBI lifted fingerprints off that black garbage bag. That led them to Hansen. In addition, the Russians provided them with a tape recording. Others thought they heard Hansen's voice, and so they put Hansen under surveillance, bought a house across the street from his, watched him 24 hours a day, and began to close in.
So the Russians sold him out?
One of the Russians sold them out. That's exactly right.
Someone gave up his file. What was the motivation?
I would venture to guess, not know for certain, that it was a combination of factors. Someone received a lot of money for that file. Someone also received the ability to, I'm told, leave Russia and live elsewhere in more of a lifestyle that he sought. So I think the motivation was a combination of things to give Hansen up. I don't think the person who turned the file over even knew who he was giving up when he gave the FBI that file. All he knew was that he was giving up the file of the FBI agent who had turned into the most notorious spy ever for Russia.
Hansen wasn't tried. There was a plea bargain. What was the outcome?
The outcome was that instead of the death penalty, Hansen got life in prison without parole, and his wife got the survivor's portion of his FBI pension.
You know, one of the things that I thought about a lot reading your book is how much the FBI had to deal with at one time, dealing with the Russians, dealing with, I mean, the year that Hansen is busted for spying is this is right after the FBI has thwarted the millennial terrorist attacks. And you describe the secret, like, this Bin Laden room that the FBI had that's just totally devoted to investigating Bin Laden. This was in the year 2000, with a poster of Bin Laden on the wall saying, "The Face of Evil."
The Face of Evil is right. There was a lot going on. There was a lot on Louis Freeh's plate at the time that he was investigating Hansen. And remarkably, Freeh was a man who immersed himself in the details of cases, so he often went inside the nerve center of the FBI and into the Bin Laden room to find out what they knew, what Bin Laden was up to, where he was. And at the same time, he had a secret meeting with the new attorney general, John Ashcroft, to tell him about the Hansen case. And when the day came, they needed to catch Hansen red-handed, because you can't make a case effectively in court for espionage, because who are you going to call to put on the witness stand? So they had to wait. They didn't want to do a sting, and they waited until Hansen made contact with the Russians. They were listening to his conversations, intercepting his communications, and they were waiting in Folkestone Park. And Hansen, after dropping off his friend Jack Hoshower at the airport, went to Folkestone Park, placed classified documents underneath the footbridge, on his way walking back to the car. FBI agents swarmed upon him, pulled their guns, and shouted, "Freeze!" He looked around them. He wasn't impressed. He wasn't surprised. And he said, "What took you so long?"
Well, David Weiss, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Terry. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
David Weiss is the author of The Bureau and the Mole. Weiss is a national staff writer for The Washington Post. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a new box set of Velvet Underground concert recordings from 1969. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. One of the most respected guitarists on the New York punk scene of the 70s was Robert Quine. He played guitar with Richard Hell and the Voidoids, and later with Lou Reed. But in the late 60s, he was just another law student at Washington University in St. Louis and a devoted Velvet Underground fan. In May 1969, he decided to record his favorite band when they played several shows in St. Louis, and later that year when they played in San Francisco. He managed to preserve on tape the best few hours of those shows. Now those tracks are collected in a new 3-CD set called the Velvet Underground Bootleg Series Volume 1, The Quine Tapes. Milo Miles has a review.
See what I mean? Imagine 100 guitars doing that at once. Okay. Well, this is a song called Rock and Roll. It's about somebody whose life was saved by rock and roll. 1, 2, 3, 4. Gina said when she was just 5 years old, there was she didn't believe what she heard at all. She started dancing to that fine, fine music. You know her life was saved by rock and roll. It took no computations to dance to a rock and roll station. It was all right. It was all right.
Lou Reed had just left the Velvet Underground when I heard the band's records for the first time. I thought I had missed out on the glory days. Rock and roll did not look back then, and the group showed every sign of becoming nothing more than a once notorious obscurity. Who would have thought 30 years ago that the most exciting concert tapes released in 2001 would not be by the Rolling Stones or Jimi Hendrix or The Who, but by the Velvet Underground? Only a few crazies back then imagined that the Velvets would contribute as much to the sound and attitude of rock as any of those 60s stars. The counterculture judgment on Lou Reed and his gang was clear. As one wise guy said, no matter how you feel when you play the Velvet Underground, they'll put you in a bad mood.
This is a song called White Light, White Heat.
But nowadays, the Velvet's bad mood sounds just like a party. By the time the Quine tapes were recorded, the two artiest members of the band, Nico and John Cale, had left, and Lou Reed's rock and roll machine was in full effect. It was really his last stand with the group. Robert Quine documented these shows with an early cassette recorder that might as well have been steam-powered. But really, only the version of Sister Ray recorded in Washington University's gymnasium has bad, boomy, and blobby sound. And the tapes have a couple surprises.
Thank you. best previous Velvet Underground concert album, Live, 1969, showed that the band wasn't just into long, abrasive freakouts, but also wanted to jam, not unlike the Grateful Dead or the Allman Brothers. The Quine Tapes also shows the group doing surprisingly folky treatments of songs like I'm Waiting for the Man. And throughout, there's Lou Reed being sarcastic and philosophical, hammy and a rock star to the bone. Maybe it's the spontaneous, unpolished performances, but it's clearer than ever before on this set that Reed was not spewing out the most shocking scenarios he could imagine. Well, not always. Sometimes he was just telling tales about friends and lovers like every other pop musician of the time. It was just that the Andy Warhol Club only accepted members who couldn't join anywhere else. But we've all met the Velvet Underground characters in the years since. By now, Duck and Sally, Margarita and Femme Fatale are as regular as Johnny B. Goode and Mac the Knife. The Quine Tapes presents them in their rough and rowdy youth. It's a gift from the past, wrapped up and preserved by a fan's love.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. He reviewed the Velvet Underground bootleg series, Volume 1, The Quine Tapes, on Polydor Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
It's the story about somebody named Duck and Sally and Cecil. Miss Rain and Miss Rosie. Other assorted friends of ours. And a late, dearly lamented, sadly deceased, and quite demented sister. Duck and Sally inside. They're cooking for the down fire. Who's staring at Miss Rayon? Sideways, Jim. Oh, just like Sister Ray said.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The Fiery Cross, a novel by Diana Gabaldon, author of The Outlander Saga, and Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Dr. Lynn Amowitz, a physician for human rights. She specializes in women's health in war-torn countries. Last month, she was in Afghanistan, interviewing women in refugee camps as B-52s drop bombs 6 miles away. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.